Welcome to the words and pictures of Raymond Briggs. His world charms and tickles children, and any grown-ups wise enough to not grow up completely. And welcome to an older England, the one that Raymond grew up in. A world of ordinary people to whom extraordinary things happen. Outside loos and red brick streets with red brick houses. Even Santa lives in one of those. He's ordinary too, if a bit grumpy. This is a world of bogeymen underground. And even slimy, mouldy bogeymen, well, they're quite ordinary too. It's a world of striped pyjamas, dressing gowns and slippers. And magical snowmen that can fly. And ordinary people when the bomb goes off. And ordinary things stop happening. Forever. It's a world where everybody loves a cuppa.
Lovely.
Even famous people who love Raymond's work. Mr. Park loves a cuppa.
Ooh, a lovely cup of tea.
And Mr. Circus loves a cuppa too. A nice cup of tea always helps. No matter how sad or magical things get in Mr. Briggs's pictures and pages, or in Mr. Briggs's real life. And it really doesn't matter where you put the tea bag.
Raymond Briggs, Snowmen, Bogeymen and Milkmen. A line drawing of Raymond from behind.
On the whole, he prefers the persona of being a slightly grumpy old man. And he is. But it's not the real Raymond.
There's a fascinated little boy somewhere inside Raymond. The magic in the books is more about emotional need than about magic. It's the heart of the sensitive soul where that magic comes from.
I can just imagine him as a child drawing and sitting there and not moving at all and just getting bigger and transforming into the man that he is now. And the world around him is changing. And these images are just sort of pouring out.
A motorbike drives past a red brick house.
Raymond's been drawing and writing for more than 50 years. He's 84 now. He lives in Sussex near the Downs in a red brick house with an old green door and grumpy messages. He's drawn 26 picture books, 25 of which he wrote, and he's been published in 19 different countries. These days, he makes just one drawing a month for the Oldie magazine.
This is usually on if I'm so-called at work here. That's my mum and dad in the garden at my last house. There's Jean, mum fiddling with her hair as usual. Oh, this is the one I'm doing at the moment. I'm supposed to have finished it every day of this week. Just me, people calling me Raymie. And me getting annoyed. Hi, Raymie. Raymie. Quite amuses me, really. That's all I do nowadays, is little tiddly drawings.
He pushes the peak of his visor up as he puts his spectacles on.
I'm never seem to get this damn job finished. I've been doing this so long, I start falling asleep. That's the trouble. I keep finding drawings I started the other day and there's a pencil line goes running away off the thing. You realise it's where you fell asleep and the pencil line goes wandering off. joys of old age. Raymie, Raymie, Raymie. There's two falling asleep pencil marks on this.
When he was a bit more sprightly, back in 1973, from his little desk in Sussex, Raymond came up with his first big success.
Father Christmas winks. Children reading the book.
It was all about a wonderful, surprising Father Christmas. Kids loved him. Even though, or especially because, he wasn't all ho, ho, ho. More a rather irritable delivery man who lived next door. He slept in a bed and had false teeth. Didn't like Christmas. Didn't like winter. Winter makes the loo seat cold.
There was a bit of a fuss because in one drawing you were depicted Father Christmas sitting on the lavatory.
Yeah, some people didn't like that. A Baptist minister's wife in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, wrote me a letter about it saying that she was horrified to see Santa Claus performing an act of personal hygiene, which was quite funny.
I love the humour of it and the way he was so grumpy and just went around making tea. Very sort of British rituals, if you like. And his sort of grumpy but mild-mannered attitude and it very much influenced Wallace, I think, and the things I did with the Grand Day Out in the first Wallace and Gromit film.
Tell you what, Gromit lad. Let's have a nice hot cup of tea. Kettle should have boiled by now.
Wallace makes the tea. Nick Park, animator.
Father Christmas had really gone in and had set me on track for what I wanted to do.
No cheese, Gromit.
But we never imagined Father Christmas like that, and so it's a reimagining of the whole thing.
I've heard it said that your Father Christmas is rather loosely modelled on your father, who was a milk ransom, wasn't he?
That's right, yes. Yes, I think that must have come into it. I didn't think of it consciously at the time. And he had a similar sort of job and a similar sort of character, really, grumbling a lot, but not in a depressing sort of way, fairly humorous kind of way.
And in the book, they meet, actually. Father Christmas is going delivering and Dad says, still at it, mate. He says, you're nearly done now. Because they're similar job. They both go out delivering on their own. It's a Father Christmas most awful job. No wonder he's grumpy.
I found Father Christmas, in a way, a little like Raymond. A grumpiness concealing a great heart. And also because it's a beautiful book. I remember also that there was some discussion with the American publishers who wanted to substitute the White House for Buckingham Palace. And Raymond wasn't having any and neither was I. So it stayed exactly as it was.
This is very British, very deadpan humour. And this beautiful, grumpy Santa. But the best thing about it was a drawing, which the whole thing was just a miracle. And I just remember one frame in particular that just, that spread. Oh, Christ.
Steve Bell, cartoonist.
Also, what I love about it, it's slightly warped. I mean, the perspective's slightly warped. It's got that comic warping to it. The perspective's slightly bizarre, but the atmosphere is just fabulous. I was just sold. I thought, I want to do that.
Father Christmas, according to you, is a grumpy old what's-it.
Well, it's bound to be. It's only being logical. And we know if you treat it logically, all these things I do, you take something that's fantastical, like Father Christmas, and from then on assume that they're real, and from then on treat it completely logically.
But the end is therefore often surreal, strange to say, isn't it? Because Father Christmas isn't a grumpy old man who goes on holiday. You have him going on holiday in another book, to Mallorca or something.
Yes, he does do that, yes. That's because I was sent away that year, or not sent away, it's the year my wife died, and friends asked me to France, other people asked me to Scotland, and the American publisher took me to New York and Las Vegas. God, awful places.
Father Christmas is in a casino. He thinks, crumbs, running out of money already. Now he's mid-air and shouting, "Here we go, dears." Next morning he says, "Hooray, home again." Raymond's going through some possessions.
That's my wife and me. Me with 60s haircut. Early 60s, I suppose. On the front of Brighton. Leather jacket, long hair, and moustache. Jesus Christ.
Raymond met his first wife, Jean, when they were both at art school in the late 1950s, the Slade School of Art in London. There he is at the back, looking young, but a little old already.
Did you kind of embrace the 60s bohemian arty lifestyle then?
Did I?
Did you?
No. No, I was too busy drawing cartoons and things.
Well, she was an artist as well, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, very good.
What was her work like? She a painter?
Yes, semi-abstract painting, really.
Your wife, Jean Raymond, died more than 30 years ago now.
Yes.
Who was also an artist, wasn't she? Mm. And beautiful and talented, you said. But she was very ill, wasn't she?
Yeah, she had schizophrenia, which is not something that I wish on anybody. Absolute nightmare. But that governed our whole lives, governed her life, of course, and governed mine for many years. She was constantly in and out of mental hospitals. Yeah.
But you decided to spend your life with her. I mean, you didn't have a choice, I suppose, if you loved her.
Yes, exactly, yes, yes. It was, the burden was for her more than for me. Mine was just helping to look after and to deal with it.
What did she die of in the end? And
leukemia. These two things ravaging this person. There we are.
I'd never forget the day of the funeral. It was just shocking grief, really. He aged in front of my eyes, really.
So you were what? You weren't 40, were
no,
you?
No.
And you'd lost everyone who was dear to you, really.
That's right, yeah. The mum had leukemia, dad had stomach cancer, I think. But, yes, she died in January. He died in the following September. And my wife died in February of the year after that.
It's a pretty bleak period.
Yeah, it was rather dreadful, sort of doing myself in a few times, but one battled on, courageously.
Did you really think of doing yourself in?
Yes, I think so. Not very seriously, but your mind turns to it, obviously, when you're going to this bloody hospital every night and seeing things getting worse.
Yeah.
Not a pretty sight.
The animation of Raymond from behind. Then a wind picks up before the rain starts to pour. He remains fixed to the spot. Robin Shaw, animator and illustrator.
I wonder what would have happened if he hadn't had that loss, the way he had it.
Contemporary film of Raymond walking along a country road wearing a coat.
Quite clearly, for me, it had a massive impact on his work. If you look at what he was doing before that, very different from what came after. This is the way he does it, keeping the world away, pretending to be grumpy, and pouring all of that emotion into the work.
You could say Raymond turned his back on the world. But that's a bit obvious, isn't it? He invented another world instead and jumped in there. This was a world where everything bad was good and things that rotted and smelt were delightful. Fungus the bogeyman lived there with his wife and son, in a joyously slimy, dank world. Kids loved this too. They still do.
A good day in Bogeyland is, you know, drinking an enormous jug full of mucus and really enjoying that. Finding nice, crispy bits of skin underneath your toenails. All the things that you would enjoy, clearly, if you lived in Bogeyland. And, of course, part of the everyday is finding delicious bits of boginess that are all around. And he makes that seem a delightful concept.
Andy Serkis, actor. Fungus wants a blocked toilet.
Everything was the opposite of us. We like light, they like dark. We like dry, they like wet, and so on. So it was all built on that principle. It's quite interesting to do. Get completely absorbed in it.
Somewhere, perhaps near where you live, Fungus the bogeyman emerges and proceeds with his nightly work. He gently wakes sleeping babies. He plunges houses into darkness. He makes things that go bump in the night.
A roof tile slips.
I was asking you whether Fungus is based on anybody, I think.
It's based on me, I think, yes. Well, being a miserable, disillusioned, depressed middle-aged man, yes, all the usual menopausal things come into that. Yes, I think that's probably... I'm wondering what it's all about and why you're doing it and what you're here for and so on.
In bed, Fungus says, "What is the purpose of our existence?" Mildew replies, "Your old dad was a wonderful bogeyman and he didn't complain." Later, he thinks, "Mildew, my first dear love and early wife."
Love is still the eternal calm of strife. He probably would never say that out loud, but that was so brilliant about him in that respect. You know, he was able to, at least he can write it down, at least he can put it down, at least he can feel those emotions and actually commit it to... It's so funny that it sort of comes right at the end as well. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Raymond spent 2 years making the underworld a fungus, and then he met someone who helped him leave it behind, a lady called Liz. Raymond moved out of his house and in with her, but not completely because of the milk. You'll understand in a moment.
How did you meet Liz?
How did I meet her?
Yeah.
Up the boozer, she's separated from her husband. He was living in London, and Jean had just died. And it was Jean and my favourite pub before Jean died. And so she was in need of a bloke and I was in need of a woman, I suppose. And we just got together.
And is this her house then? I was trying, is that right?
Yes, it's her house.
Yeah. You prefer being here now rather than at your house?
Yes, it's so isolated down there. Very beautiful place, but it's a little bit cut off.
Do you go back at all?
I'll go back every day. Still have the milk delivered there. Pick up the milk. Got to support the milk trade because my dad was a milkman. And, slightly mad, but what can you do? Can't move out for good because there's nowhere to put all the stuff. There's a house full of 30-odd years of stuff.
He lifts a roller blind. Claire Benjamin, Liz's daughter.
His work is such an important part of who he is, and Mum really got that, and really got that if he wasn't working, he got quite grumpy or restless, that he needed to be working on a book, that that's who he was. And I think she really enjoyed, like, and was very good at creating a really lovely home, and she worked really hard. Like, I look back and think, she was a full-time teacher, she brought us up, you know, and grew veg, and, you know, she really did work hard, but she never complained about being busy. There was a kind of air of calm around it. So all of that domestic life and routine was really important for him.
Raymond's always been really private about when he's working on something. It's sort of that he doesn't want to talk about it, and I think he feels he'll talk out the desire to do it, and it kind of has to stay in his own private world.
Tom Benjamin, Liz's son. The illustration of the snowman and James flying through the air hand in hand above a hilly landscape and the sun obscured by cloud.
But in your next book, you did make really quite a contrast with that, didn't you? This is the snowman, which not only had no text at all, but with its concentration on pure white things, has a completely different tone from Fungus the Bogeyman.
Yes, well, that was done as a reaction, I think, because, I'd been 2 years immersed in all this slime and muck and whatnot and wanted to do something different and something lighter and quicker, less laborious, no words, and totally different, just for the sake of a change. And that's how that came about, really.
I do remember very vividly when he brought us in. He didn't like to be in the room when I was looking at his work. He'd go outside, and he gave me the boards with the work on it, and outside he went. And he came back in, and he found me in floods of tears. And he said, "You don't like it." And I said, "Raymond, they're just tears of pure joy because it is so beautiful."
Women you've never met before coming up to me in a street or in an art gallery or something, say, "Oh, Mr. Briggs, I love your snowman book. I bought it for my children and now I'm buying it for my grandchildren." That's wonderful. It's gone right through two generations. It could go on forever, like Beatrice Potter or something.
The snowman was all drawn with coloured pencils, like a proper children's book drawn by a child. It's 40 years old now, but it hasn't grown up at all. It sold 5.5 million copies in 21 countries, and there aren't any words in it, apart from the title, which makes it terribly easy to translate.
The snowman was a great example of just the power of pictures, really. It captures something about childhood in a really magical way that predates dialogue, really. I could just sit and pore over the drawings and become fully absorbed. I used to get so absorbed just in the drawings.
It's a perfect story about a little boy who must be, I think, very like Raymond was. It's just beautifully done, and it's utterly silent. It's beautiful. You don't need any dialogue. It's as quiet as when it snows. It's got that wonderful silence to it. And even when the snowman sort of knocks things over, you can't really hear them. It's kind of dreamlike.
Posy Simmons, cartoonist, writer and illustrator. A sequence of drawings from the book showed James in bed, then running downstairs with his dressing gown over his blue and white striped pyjamas. He runs past his mother and father at the breakfast table, then finds the melted snowman in the garden, a floppy hat, scarf and pieces of coal.
I remember thinking, A, what a perfect ending it was, and B, what an annoying ending it was, because it was so sad. By looking at the boy's back, we're sort of invited to join him in feeling that emotion, whereas if we had his face to us, it would be a question of we're watching him. We're watching him feeling that, but having the back there, we get sucked into being him.
The film.
Raymond knew that everything melts, and he made it into this wonderful, simple story that's happy, then sad. They made a film of it in 1982, and for most of us, it's as Christmas as turkey and mince pies. It's just like watching the book, really. And suddenly the pictures move.
An excited James jumps from bed and goes to the window to watch the snow falling.
If you did a rendition of the snowman or Raymond's work, I was just so hoping it would reflect his original comic book artwork, and it did. The fact that the animators had been true to Raymond's style. It was groundbreaking and thrilling to see.
James meets the snowman for the first time. children captivated by the film. Hilary Aldiss and Joanna Harrison, animators.
Hilary and I did the storyboard. We developed the whole idea from this book. It was snow. We assumed it was Christmas time. Although there's no Christmas trees in the house, we introduced a Christmas tree in the house. We introduced flying to the North Pole and Father Christmas and the scarf and the motorcycling sequence. We had to expand the story. I mean, the book is the storyboard for a film. It's absolutely perfect, but we did ask to see the original drawings because we wanted to get the hand-drawn look, but you can't draw with crayon on cell. It's impossible. So we experimented. We thought, do you remember, we used to put hairspray on cell and see if we could put a crayon onto it to give it some kind of purchase.
But it just slides off, you know.
It slides off. So in the end, what did we do? We used wax crayon. It was the wax crayons that gave it that boily Raymond look. That we wanted it to look like the book. That was the most important thing.
The snowman takes to the air with James. He has a protective arm around the boy. An animation of a hand drawing. A sketch of a woman pouring milk from a jug based on Vermeer's The Milkmaid.
A Bruegel. One of the Bruegels, don't ask me which.
What do you like about that, then?
I just like all his work. Vermeer more than anybody. Wish I could have gone to the Vermeer exhibition. Can't go anywhere nowadays.
You decided quite early that you wanted to be a cartoonist.
Yes, that was quite early, about 12 or 13. I don't know why, I just was interested in the humour and the drawing side of it.
Wanting just to be a cartoonist was something particular sorts of grown-ups thought was silly, which Raymond found out when he was 15 and went to visit his first art school in Wimbledon, where there was a gruesomely serious head teacher.
So tell me, boy, why do you want to come to my art school? Well, sir, I want to learn to draw so that I can be a cartoonist. A what? A cartoonist? Good God, boy, is that all you want to do? Well, yes.
So 6 years of fine art school had attempted to drum the child out of Raymond's head. But fortunately, after he'd graduated, he went to Oxford University Press, where there was a lady called Mabel, who knew at once what Raymond's head and fingers were really for.
I'm meeting the redoubtable Miss Mabel George. She was the doyenne of children's books at the time, to show her my work. And quite good. Tell me, how do you feel about fairies? Fairies, I thought. Fairy stories. 4 years at Wimbledon, 2 years at the Slade, head full of Bruegel, Rembrandt and Piero della Francesca. Has it really come down to this? And I managed to keep all that inside. And said, oh, fairy stories, I said. Brothers Grimm, Hans Andersen, wonderful. Never having read a word of any of them. But she was dead right. I found that nursery rhymes, fairy stories, were just what I should have been doing. Not trying to be a fine art artist. Commercial art, wonderful, just a job for me.
So in 1958, Raymond made the pictures for a children's book by a lady called Ruth, a collection of folk and fairy tales from Cornwall, where pixies are piskies. And he went on doing the pictures for other writers, remembering all about giants covered in seaweed, windy shoemakers, and terrible witches with one eye and an unwise hairdo. Until he wrote his own first book in 1961. It was called The Strange House, and it had more words than pictures. For a while, he went on making books like that, and sometimes he drew the house he grew up in and his milkman dad. Then one day, he realised he wanted more pictures and less words. But he still kept drawing the house he grew up in and his milkman dad.
As to the actual mirror that we had at home, part of my whole childhood, that mirror used to judge my height in it against the window frame. And I'd grown again. I was 5'2" for bloody ages.
If Raymond were asked to draw, I don't know, a table or a chair, it's highly likely that that chair would be a chair from his childhood. It'd be a chair that belonged to his mum and dad. It would have emotional weight to it.
The mirror hangs above the fireplace in an illustration, then film of Raymond in his 40s.
Inspired by the ordinary and the everyday, Raymond creates extraordinary worlds, and not just for children. Some of his books are about being tired of being treated like a child. Tired of a world where everything melts, and not just because it does, but because very stupid people have decided to melt it.
Raymond Briggs, When the Wind Blows. A copy of the Protect and Survive booklet scrunches up into a ball. The War Game is projected onto a screen. Alan Baker, illustrator.
Well, I remember going with Raymond to see the film The War Game, which was a BBC film, which I think the BBC banned. I think it was made, and then it was banned because it was seen as being too, probably too disturbing. But local village halls were showing them. And Raymond and I drove to Billingshurst, which is about 10 miles from here. And it felt very exciting in a weird way to be sitting in this village hall, seeing this film that had been banned. And it was disturbing.
The panicking couple in the film with their children.
The blast wave from a thermonuclear explosion has been likened to an enormous door slamming in the depths of hell.
Terrifying at the time. I mean, you had these two superpowers head to head, literally, their fingers virtually on the triggers. They'd only got to pick up a phone, and they could obliterate, if not the whole world, at least Western civilization, within minutes or hours. I don't know how we all lived with it at that time, really, because it was a huge worry at the back of people's minds. Even if you weren't consciously thinking about it, it was there, present all the time.
I was a member of UCND and very active in the peace movement, and myself and my brother and Raymond went to a meeting in the local village hall, my mum's village, and there was instructions on like the role that WRVS will play after the bombs dropped, and there's a rugby team from Newark that are going to keep law and order. And it was obviously quite absurd because it was this sense of trying to treat a nuclear war like it was going to be the Second World War, not to undermine the carnage of that. And I think that whole thread of Raymond thinking, well, how would people like my parents, that, you know, people of that generation that trusted in authority and been through the Second World War, cope with this scenario? So that having debates and discussions about nuclear war and all of us watching things like Threads together and The War Game and being in floods of tears and being really worried and scared about nuclear war, that was really part of the atmosphere of the time, and it was in our household as well, in our family as well. So I do remember all of those discussions, and I thought When the Wind Blows was amazing, and it obviously triggered debates in the House of Commons and was just had a massive influence on the national debate in a really good way.
Inside the book, a headline reads, "Meanwhile on a distant plane with a nuclear missile." Jim says, "Funny to think they were on our side in the war." Hilda asks, "Who, dear?" "The Ruskies with old Joe Stalin." "Meanwhile, in a distant ocean, a nuclear submarine." Julia McRae, Raymond's editor.
Well, I was always surprised whenever I saw anything new from him, because I never knew what to expect. It was a book of its times. It wasn't cheerful, but it was certainly a book of its times, and it had quite an impact. There were some who really hated it and others who thought it was very timely.
I find it so upsetting, incredibly upsetting, absolutely awful. Awful, awful, awful. I can't read it. But which is a shame, because artistically, it is probably one of the best, I think, most adventurous.
It's quite an interesting image in When the Wind Blows, I think it was, which I actually find very funny, but you know. In a way, he says it always, to the nuclear bomb going off. And again, it's quite an avant-garde and quite a conceptual thing to do for a children's book. And great that people like him could do that. Not many people could do that and get away with it. Where's the picture?
The two characters, Jim and Hilda, are they based on people known to you?
Well, they're somewhat like my parents, though I like to think my parents weren't quite as dim as they are. But they have to be dim to follow, protect and survive, you see.
I was so incensed by that protect and survive leaflets the government put out about how to guard against nuclear war and building shelters and things. The whole shelf of it over there, still there. Lay in supplies, because you're supposed to take shelter for weeks on end. So you've got to lay in food, drink for so many weeks, they told you.
Jim says, well, they say you should get into a paper bag just before the bomb goes off.
Raymond stayed angry enough to turn When the Wind Blows into something without any pictures at all. A radio play for the BBC.
Hello, dear.
Hello, love. Did you have a nice morning, dear?
It was very, upsetting at the read-through, because when you're writing, it takes several weeks to write, and then another 18 months or so to illustrate it, and I got completely detached from it in all that time, I think. And having the whole lot thrown at you in the space of an hour, it was much more moving than I thought it was. I thought it was quite funny, the book, actually. But it was quite upsetting.
We are interrupting this programme for an official government announcement. An enemy missile attack
shut up!
Launched against this country.
For God's sake, shut up!
You and your blessed news.
3 minutes. 3 minutes.
God almighty, Dax, there's only 3 minutes to go!
Oh, stay indoors. Oh, dear. I'll just get the washing in.
Come back, you stupid bitch. Get inside.
How dare you talk to me like that?
Shut up and get in the shelter.
There's no need to forget our manners just because there's a war.
Get in! Get in!
I've never heard such language in my life.
For God's sake, get in!
Do not leave your home.
Oh, dear. I've left the oven on.
This, as an official government... The cake will be burnt.
In a clip from the film, the nuclear blast tears through houses, reducing them to rubble. A fleeing sheep's bowled over by the explosion.
And when it was all turned into a film, Raymond wrote the words for that too.
Crockery smashes into their wedding photo on the wall, knocking it to the floor. Jim's lying on top of Hilda in their makeshift shelter.
Blimey. Blimey.
Well, I never...
I suppose that was it.
I should think so.
Blimey. You all right, dear?
Yes, thanks, love. Oh, dear. I do feel all shaky.
Never mind, Dux. We're still in one piece, eh?
Yes, I think so.
I think he makes it real because it's set in domesticity. It's tiny little details like putting the kettle on and Hilda all the time worrying about things. And even when awful things are happening to them, they're, I think Jim is bleeding. And she says, "Oh, on your nice shirt." And You know, it's just sort of mundane details which make it very, very real and very, very touching.
Hilda asks, shall we get into those paper bags again?
But of course he's wonderful at dialogue. It's a difficult thing. It's partly because he's a very, very good writer. And I think he's also a very good actor and he's a very good director.
Hilda says, oh, it's stuffy in these bags.
Raymond Briggs, he of the Snowman, Father Christmas, Fungus the Bogeyman and When the Wind Blows fame, this week publishes his latest picture book. It's called The Tin Pot Foreign General and the Old Iron Woman and is, he says, a folktale.
The Old Iron Woman is a gigantic metal creation astride a warship. She has large-caliber machine guns pointing out of her breasts. The general roars, I bags the island.
Raymond never said it was the Falklands War, because it so obviously was. He didn't have to.
Her machine gun nipples are blasting.
I mean, you know, probably, you know, one would think, what's he thinking these days? But it was a really powerful, really extraordinary piece of work.
I get the impression that you're not particularly fond of Mrs. Thatcher, is that right?
I don't know what gives you that idea.
From the book, what's your view of her?
Yeah, so I do think she's got a bit more extreme than she was. And it's possibly getting worse all the time.
The style of the drawing, the whole style of the book, is very different from anything you've done in the past. There are none of these friendly little characters who people can identify with, and none of your verbal humour. Why is that?
Well, there's not many friendly little characters involved in the story. The main two protagonists weren't very friendly, I don't think, or very funny, and there's not much verbal humour because nobody says anything much except rejoice, which I thought was slightly humorous in the circumstances.
The bombed-out Fortress HQ.
It's in the form that it is because I felt the whole thing was horribly like a folktale. You know, with the wicked giants and the manipulation of ordinary people by the wicked giants. It seemed very like a folktale to me.
The thing about Raymond is he's not afraid of speaking his mind. He's not afraid of being absolutely laser about his intentions. And he can be very subtle with that, but he can also be, you know, he can be... this is obviously an angry piece of work and a heartbroken piece of work. You know, you see the destruction. Some men were burnt alive. I mean... some men were drowned.
Another page.
Yeah, that's so shocking and dark. I mean, that is like kind of one of the World War I artists, isn't it?
Some men were shot, and a line drawing.
Looking back on the whole operation, not just the way you've reflected it in the book, was it all a complete waste to you?
Yes, I'm afraid I think it was, yes. It should never have happened. I don't think one single person should have been killed about it. It wasn't worth one single human life.
See, in regards to your books, When the Wind Blows and Tin Pot Foreign General, do you think they're still relevant today?
Oh, well, yes, When the Wind Blows, very much so recently because of career and all that. I thought guessing about these stupid wars. I only just missed being in the Korean War by about a few months. People of my age, I'm now 84, just hearing about it on the radio this morning. It was so many years ago, and people of my age were being killed there. Absolutely unbelievable to defend this bloody little spit of land sticking out to stop it being communist, when half the old world is communist above it. Absolute madness to go out there and get killed for that. I was praying that my deferment, I had deferment on National Service to complete my art school course, and that just saved me from going to Korea. Bloody hell.
That was a very close shave. And war rumbled about when he was little too, when he was evacuated because of the Blitz and had to leave his mum and dad behind in London, which was where he grew up. Raymond was born in Wimbledon in 1934. He was the only child of Ethel and Ernest Briggs. As we know already, Ernest was a milkman. His mum Ethel was a lady's maid. Raymond made a book about them in 1998. It looked just like a children's book, but it wasn't really. And they made a film of it too.
People in a cinema are watching Ethel and Ernest. Ernest positions Raymond's mirror on the mantelpiece.
Ed! Surprise, dear.
Oh.
New mirror.
It's lovely. However did you get it home?
I walked it back on my bike pedal.
How much was it?
Only half a dollar. I got it off a Didycoy down home.
I've got a surprise for you too.
Oh, yes?
I've been to, the doctor.
Oh, and? You mean... We're going to... Yippee!
I can't believe it!
Oh, Ed!
Blue skies around the corner.
Happy birthday, darling!
Oh, Ernest. And your cars, they get bigger every year. This one's all padded. But my best present isn't due until January.
More tea, Ed.
Ethel and Ernest is supposed to be a book about his parents, but it's really more of an autobiography of himself. He is the central character in it. You get from it the importance he attaches to the world he was brought up in, the world of his parents, is a completely different world from the world people live in now.
Richard Ingrams, journalist and editor. In the book, Ethel says, "Oh, Ernest, look, there's a bathroom." "Blimey," he replies. Later she says, "He's gone. Don't cry, darling, he'll be safe down the country. He's only five." Now the boy's being warned to keep away from the electric milk float as it's dangerous. Ernest finds Ethel crying. He says he wants to leave the grammar school and go to art school. "Art school?" Ernest exclaims. Later the couple say, "Look at the pair of them. They're art students. He'll grow out of it when he gets a proper job. He'll never get a proper job with hair like that." She goes in and out of the loony bin. "She's mental?" Mum asks. "She has schizophrenia, so I won't be a granny." "Never mind, Mum."
There's never been a book like it, and it's a perfect book because it's so expressive, and it's the sort of book that moves you to tears pretty well because it's so intense, but so simply and sort of in the same Raymond way, kind of deadpan, offbeat humour, but depicting something he clearly loves. You know, those two people he loved deeply. And it's one of the most moving things. Comic book, I'd describe it as the moving books I've ever read. It's just fabulous. But that just shows, you know, what he can do, what he's done. He's a genius.
In the book, "Mr. Briggs, is there a telephone? I need to call an ambulance."
"What's that music? I can hear music."
"Carol's mum, on the television. It's Christmas. There's the tree, look."
"Oh, I hope I'll be home in time for Christmas. When is it?"
"It was yesterday, Mum. You had your presents yesterday."
Ernest puts a comforting hand on his son's shoulder. Then he leaves him at Ethel's bedside.
"Look at all your cards. Lovely flowers."
"Yes, lovely. And our lucky girl."
A tearful Ernest goes out.
"Listen, dear. Who was that old man in here just now?"
"Oh, Mum. That was Dad."
A woman watching is moved. In the book, on the phone, "Son, is that you? The hospital. They just phoned. She's..." "I'll see you there," says Ernest. He's grey and gaunt. Leaning against the door, he says, "Steady on, old son." Now, father and son are at the hospital with Ethel's body. She's wearing a white shroud with a covering on her head.
The most difficult thing in the book was doing my parents' death, of course. My mum stuck on a trolley in the hospital at St Thomas's. And my dad passing away normally in a hospital in Wimbledon. I kept doing those in bits and coming back to them, you know, because it was a bit upsetting to do. I'd do about half an hour, then come back the next day and do a bit more. But it was fairly grim, her being on that trolley.
A fearless book. Who would do that? Most people would shy away from revealing so much of themselves. And that must have been so hard to do.
I think the way he handles death in his Ethel and Alice book is beautifully done, actually. The death of the mother and the father. Brilliant.
Ernest says, I still keep laying the table for two, Duck. Daft, isn't it, Susie? Puss.
The way Raymond has drawn his father's hands hanging onto the sink, I always notice them. They're sort of red with the effort of clinging on to life. And it's a terribly powerful image. I mean, it's terribly sad. Yeah, I can remember crying at them. Yes.
It's okay, Susie.
Raymond, I don't say he's got an obsession with death, but he is worried about it. But I think we all are, to some extent. When a lot of your friends die, your relations die, you can't help thinking about death a lot and thinking about people who are dead. I do it a lot myself. It's a good thing to talk about it and to write about it, because otherwise people tend to think, well, we don't want to know about that.
The man's holding his dead dad's hand. Another woman in the cinema audience dabs under her eyes.
I think he's absolutely unflinching about showing everything about life. I don't think he's actually very morbid, although he's got a good sense that, you know, part of life is death.
The son lifts his parents' wedding photo from the wall.
Yeah, a lot of his books are about death. You know, Ethel and Ernest ends with the death of his parents. When the Wind Blows ends with the death of everybody, really. Snowman disappears into nothing.
Do you think about death a lot, Raymond?
Yes, I suppose so. You're getting near it, you have to think about it. Surrounded by all these things of death anyway.
It's in all your books as well.
Is it?
Somebody, yeah, pretty much.
What, death, really?
Yeah.
Well, you can't avoid it, I suppose.
A light switch.
There's another book by Raymond. It's called Time for Lights Out, and it's all poems and memories. It's not finished yet. Raymond stopped working on it when his partner Liz fell ill. And then he looked after her instead, until she died 3 years ago. They'd been together 40 years.
Mm-hmm. There's one bit about the children, I think. Yes, this is kids. Girl four says, you go to Granny's every day, don't you? That was Liz. Yes, that's right. She's your partner, isn't she? Yes, that's it. A small hand touches inside my arm. Boy two says, you are my partner, Raymond.
He's moved.
How sweet that was. Oh, dear.
He doesn't tend to have heart-to-heart type conversations with people so much, but I think he feels things a lot, you know, and cares about people a lot. So although it's not not necessarily all spoken about, but it's there, definitely, yeah.
Raymond's an incredibly sensitive person. He carries... You can see it in him. He carries an awful lot of emotion, a lot of which he hides, but he cannot hide it from his work.
All Raymond's works are very personal. You can kind of tell it, even just by the way it's coloured in. You know, you can tell there's an artist working there painstakingly and lovingly on each image, on each page.
Raymond's working on a drawing with a selection of pencils in his left hand.
The trouble with a lot of illustrators, they don't draw from the inside, you know, they draw a figure doing what it's doing, but it's not being felt from inside. If you can do it, that's the essence of good illustrating, I think, is when you can feel what the person is feeling and draw what the person is feeling and what he's doing. That's the difference between that sort of illustrating and the photographic kind of illustration. And not many people do that.
A bird feeding in the garden.
I think his own experience gives his books a sort of authenticity. I mean, they ring true. They affect you. You suffer with the characters. But you also rejoice with them. I mean, like Father Christmas having a cup of tea at the end of his long day delivering presents.
Good cup of tea, Father Christmas says.
He understands people, he understands life, what it's like.
A succession of children captivated by Raymond's work. Several grown-ups in the cinema audience laughing out loud. A girl thrilled at what she sees.
He speaks so directly to the child, and even in the child and the adult. You, me. I mean, we react in a way that a child would to some extent.
Raymond's reading through some fan mail.
People say they've been reading my books all their life or something. God. Hundreds of these bloody things. Very nice to get them. Fantastic. It's very encouraging. The quantity of it is astonishing. Liverpool. One from Ireland. Oh, what's this?
A handwritten note reads, Raymond, you are really funny. Lots of love. A letter from Theo, age 7, saying Ethel and Ernest is his favourite book.
To Raymond Briggs. I... Ike, your, yours, he means books. Oh, Michel keeps on saying, you're dead. Do you read Boas from Dawn? Keeps on saying I'm dead. Brilliant.
Blooming that. Happy blooming Christmas.
Why did the snowman get it?
He melted.
Oh. He'll come back to life next Christmas, right?
Mm-hmm.